This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
So in Australia, the Pharmaceutical Benefits Advisory Committee, or PBAC, is an independent expert body appointed by the Australian government. Its primary role is to recommend new medicines for listing on the PBS or Pharmaceutical Benefits Scheme. Its members include doctors, other health professionals, health economists, and consumer representatives. No new medicine can be listed unless the committee makes a positive recommendation. When recommending a medicine for listing, the PBAC takes into account the medical conditions for which the medicine was registered for use in Australia by the TGA, its clinical effectiveness, and its safety and cost effectiveness. In other words, its value for money compared with other treatments available. I'm Rick Day, DIA Global Forum Regional Editor for Australia and New Zealand. Today, we're speaking with Professor Andrew Wilson, who has chaired the Pharmaceutical Benefits Advisory Committee since 2015. In addition to serving as PBAC Chair, Professor Wilson is co-director of the Australian Prevention Partnership Centre and co-director of the Menzies Centre for Health Policy at the University of Sydney. He joins us today to discuss the cost and cost-effectiveness of pharmaceuticals and the role of the PBAC in Australia. Thank you very much for joining us today, Andrew, and welcome.
Delighted to talk to you again, Rick.
Thank you. Andrew, I'm just going to ask you some questions and look forward to hearing your answer and maybe some discussion. So firstly, how's the role of the PBAC changed over the last few years?
Thanks, Rick. Look, fundamentally, the PBAC processes haven't changed. Fundamentally, we still have to consider the comparative safety and cost effectiveness of therapies. We have to consider the overall cost impacts of that and advise government in making our recommendations for listings on the PBAC that we think that there is a need for the drug, that it's cost effective, and some indication of what the likely total cost of that drug will be. In terms of the processes of the PBAC, there have, however, been a number of changes over the period of time. I think particularly in the last few years, probably the thing I'm most pleased about is the extent that we are seeking more patient and consumer inputs into our decision making. I don't think we're fully there yet. We've still got a ways to go, but we have really progressed this. We have consumer representatives on all of our principal committees. The deputy chair of the committee is our senior consumer representative on the committee. We have patient hearings. We have a unit within the Commonwealth Department of Health, which acts to actively engage with patient groups to seek their inputs in relation to it. And as part of our process of consideration, we ask that the discussants for particular medicines, when they're presented to the PBAC, include in their presentation the input that we've had from patients around this input. So I think we have substantially increased the level of that input. I think, again, this is something which is going to continue to evolve. There'll be, I'm sure, some further changes around that in the future. There have been some organisational changes in terms of the way we operate. Your listeners may or may not appreciate that the Pharmaceutical Benefits Advisory Committee is largely submission-driven. We're sort of reactive to applications, largely from pharma companies making submissions for subsidy. We have limited capacity to go out and actively seek medicines. That's one of our, one of limitations. One of the things I'd like to see us being given more scope to be able to more actively fill needs. Now, as part of that process, over the last few years, we have tried to provide more guidance to companies making applications to the PBAC. We have an extensive set of guidelines which companies are encouraged to use in making their applications. We now have an electronic portal for submissions, and the feedback around that portal has been very positive, that it makes it easier for companies to make their applications to us. We have streamlining of applications, so applications are identified early in the process according to characteristics such as whether this is an innovator drug, something new, or whether it's a drug that we've seen a similar drug before and it's an extension of an indication of a drug. And that has implications for the way we consider those drugs as they go through the system. And we now have depending on the outcomes, if we make a positive recommendation for a listing, we weigh up whether a drug has high added therapeutic value. And if we consider that a drug has high added therapeutic value, then there is a fast track mechanism for getting that medicine listed. If medicines are not recommended, we now have a triaging system about the speed at which that drug or the medicine might be reconsidered by the PBAC. So if we think the application was pretty close, basically, there were only a few things that really needed to be fixed up in relation to it. We have then, depending on whether we consider it has high therapeutic value or is another useful medicine to have, but doesn't necessarily break new grounds in relation to that, then there are two separate pathways for faster pathways for those to resubmit. Separating out those which are more complicated, where really there's a lot more work to be done. And again, even in those ones where there is, we think, really a lot more that needs to be sorted out before we're going to be able to make a judgment about the value, we also now have what's called a facilitated pathway for drugs where we consider there could potentially be high added therapeutic value. There is the opportunity for an interaction, a workshop, essentially to work out and resolve some of the issues that are there. So those post-PBAC processes have substantially changed as well, but the intrinsic parts of our decision-making process haven't changed very much.
Oh, thanks, Andrew. There's a lot of developments there that are very positive, and you've been very busy since last time we talked. Just on the matter of the technique of working out incremental cost effectiveness, what's your view about the quality of evidence and how that's being dealt with and whether that's improved over the last few years?
This is a really interesting question. I'd have to say that the overall impression is that I have around this is that, and the way I describe it is that our decision making is becoming harder. And one of the reasons it's becoming harder is because we're being asked to make decisions with substantially more uncertainty about the benefits, the safety, and the value propositions. Because medicines are coming to the market earlier because patient and clinician expectations of having access to those medicines and also for commercial reasons. And one of the consequences of medicines coming for consideration earlier is the quality of information that's available to you is less. You have less time for follow-up. You're getting more decisions being made on the basis of markers rather than, say, for example, overall survival. And so these things all add a level of uncertainty. So I don't think the quality of the information has fallen. It's just that we're seeing it earlier in the drug development program process to be considered. And so there is more uncertainty associated with it.
No, I understand.
Now, with some medicines, and particularly what we're seeing with some of the rarer conditions, is another level of uncertainty, and that is that particularly with very rare conditions, it's more likely that we'll be seeing data from non-randomized studies. And again, it's not that that's new. We've had that for a while, but just because there has been this explosion of medicines for rare diseases, that we're seeing more of those sort of and being asked to consider more of those types of situations.
Thanks, Andrew. And I think it leads on to my next question, which is about the what I would have thought was a proliferation of what you might call precision medicines based on mechanisms across, you know, areas like oncology and immunology, rheumatology, chronic inflammatory disorders, where there's just an explosion of IBs and ABs and related drugs that are quite specific. It's if sort of broad categories of disorder like rheumatoid arthritis are really a bunch of disorders now with different mechanisms. So the assessment of those medicines, because there's just so many of them, what sorts of challenges does this provide? I mean, I think you've answered it in part by talking about the push to get these things registered faster and earlier, but just simply that the precision and the actual mechanisms and the number of these drugs seems to be overwhelming.
I think it does present a number of new challenges for us. None that I think are ones that we can't overcome, but these things do take a little while to work out how you're going to handle them. It's important to recognise that when we talk about precision medicine, we're talking about a range of different things which might be more precise. At one extreme, you have a situation where you have some sort of biomarker, you know, usually either some sort of receptor or genomic feature, which means that the medicine won't work unless you've got that particular biomarker present. So that sort of absolute indication, absolute precision in relation to it. And then you have the ones where it's more of a relative indication. So as an example, when the PD-L1 inhibitors first started to come out, there was a sort of sense that you had to have be PD-L1 positive for these drugs to work. Well, it soon became apparent that no, actually it's more of a gradient effect. The more that you have expression of that in present, then more likely you are to respond to one of these great agents. But most people will respond to some extent. In fact, probably given the imprecision of the measurement of that, even those that appear to be zero probably have some response in relation. So it's a more of a relative response in that sort of situation. Now, one of the consequences of the first type of precision that I was talking about is that it actually starts to fragment up different diseases. So if you take lung cancer and you look at those genomic markers within lung cancer, you end up with a much smaller group of patients. And that has implications both for the ability to trial the drug, getting enough patients to conduct the sort of traditional trials, but it also has implications for the way companies will price medicines for those different types of situations. There are flow-on consequences around that. The other sort of major challenge that comes out of it is, of course, we're no longer just having to evaluate the drug, we're also having to evaluate the test that determines the drug. We have to consider things like the false negative, false positive rates with those tests and how that might influence the definition of the patient population. And importantly, the prevalence of those markers in the patient population, which will determine, for example, the number of people that are going to have to be tested to identify those people who are most likely to respond to the medicine. Now, again, these things appear really challenging at this point, but this is a field which is evolving so rapidly. I don't anticipate this is going to be a problem, you know, even 5 years from now, particularly for the genomic characterization will become a normal part of most diseases within a short period of time. But as always, there's a period of going from where we are now to where that becomes a routine part of care.
Thanks very much, Andrew. There's been this goal for quite some time to have a closer collaboration with the TGA in progressing submissions, both for registration, but also listing on the PBS. So how is that process proceeding? Is that sort of saving time and effort for both PBAC and TGA?
There's some really interesting aspects of what's come out of some of this. So the first thing to say is Australia's been a leading in parallel processing of medicine. So most new medicines in Australia, there'll be an application to both the TGA and the PBAC at the same time or pretty close to the same time, and we will look at those. And the time to first decision around a listing in Australia, this is not necessarily a positive listing, but to time to first decision has fallen quite markedly in Australia because of that parallel processing in relation to these medicines. So I think that's been a fantastic development. Of course, we'd like to, our aim when presented with a medicine where we think there is a need in the Australian community is to try and get it listed as quickly as possible. To do that, however, we have to meet our needs. And as I was sort of flagging before, we don't always get what we need to make the decision to be able to make that recommendation. Another feature of this sort of, though, that has impacted on us here is that the TGA in Australia now has these two new pathways. It has a pathway for drugs which have been assessed through one of a comparable regulatory agency overseas and already been approved. And so they get a sort of expedited consideration. That hasn't really changed a lot for us. It just means that those things come to us a bit faster, and that's a good thing. The one which is more problematic is that the TGA now has what's called a provisional pathway for drugs which they consider have substantial additional therapeutic value. They may register the drug at a much earlier stage than they would have previously. Now, that presents a much bigger challenge for us for, again, going back to those reasons I was talking about before, the level of uncertainty. and remembering that we're interested in sort of comparative safety and comparative effectiveness. And generally, when you get these drugs, this is very early, you know very little about their comparative effectiveness and safety to other drugs which are available. That those things usually always come later in the development cycle.
Understood. Sort of related in terms of collaborative efforts, what about the collaboration with the Health Technology Advisory Committee? You've already addressed that a little bit, I guess, with tests, but again, these hybrid products, medicines, device products.
So there are two things here, Rick. The first is we're seeing with a lot of the cell and gene therapies that are coming along, the question arises as to what's the best pathway for the evaluation of these medicines. It may well be that the medicine part of this plays a very small part, actually, in the overall therapy, and in particular, in the very small part in the overall costs of that particular line of treatment. And it may well be that the medicine or the therapy is one which is going to be primarily given in hospital, and the PBS is not set up to fund medicines within hospitals. So to consider this early, we now have a process, a sort of triage process, if you like, with the new cell and gene therapies, whereby the chair of the PBAC, myself, the chair of the Medical Services Advisory Committee, Professor Robin Ward, and I, and a representative of the state and territory health systems, meets and considers where this would fit in that sort of spectrum of things, of activities. And we make a decision whether the most appropriate evaluation pathway is through the PBAC and funding on the PBS, or whether it's going to be funded through some other mechanism, in which case the evaluation would normally be done through the Medical Services Advisory Committee pathways. And so, for example, CAR T therapy, when we considered CAR T therapy, it could have gone either way, but when we weighed it up, basically a very significant proportion of the costs of CAR T therapy are in the patient care components, which are essentially in hospital. Most of the therapy is provided within a hospital context. So it went through the MSAC pathway. With some of the gene replacement therapies, it's not quite as clear. Because there's basically relatively, I say that carefully, but relatively easy to give. And so the decision which way they would go has varied a bit depending on where we think the most appropriate comparator is for the therapy in relation that it might be replacing. What we're seeing is that these committee decisions they're becoming much closer aligned. We have mechanisms to try and make sure that they're coordinated. But it wouldn't surprise me if there are further changes in relation to the relationship between the committees and how things occur in future as we try and work through the complexities of health technology assessment for these new cell and gene therapies.
Thanks very much, Andrew. Sorry for interrupting there, but it sounds like the collaboration's going well and decisions are being made. So maybe to wrap up, I was just wondering about your views about how we can afford the emerging medicines, given all our discussion and I guess the complexity of medicines increasing. Do you see that our system is fit for purpose? Will it continue to work in serving the people, serving the taxpayer going forward? So I'd be just keener for a general sense of how well this system will look after us for the next years.
Look, I mean, the first thing I'd say is that if we stop asking questions about how we can do things better, then we've lost the game. So we always have to ask ourselves, is what we do fit for purpose? Are there better ways of doing it, et cetera? I mean, I think fundamentally the intent of what we try to do hasn't changed. It's still there for the right reasons. But are there ways that we can do it better? Yeah, I mean, I'm always open to considering that. The second issue is that you raised is, you know, can we afford these things? Well, fortunately, they're not all going to arrive tomorrow. If they did, if we had suddenly had gene therapy for the 40,000 plus people in Australia who have a rare inherited condition, and we were paying at the price that we're currently paying for gene therapies, then it would be an impossible task for government. But that's not how it's emerging. It's going to emerge slowly. And while this will accelerate, while there'll be more of them, I believe the Australian healthcare system and the expenditure will grow to meet those needs, you know, as they emerge. I think the purpose of the PBAC is to ensure that the money that we spend gets the best value for what's there while delivering on patient needs. And our processes ensure, probably better than almost any other system in government, that there is a high value return on the expenditure that in the PBS. Yes, it may grow, but people can be assured that there is value in that.
Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's a very positive note to finish on, and I think it's entirely justified. So congratulations on the continuing good work. So, look, we've finished with the questions and I'd like to thank you very much for your time and telling us all about PBAC and its progress and where you're up to. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Rick.
For DIA Global Forum, I am Rick Day.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.